to write a book, and it's not because it's easy. It's the hardest project I've ever worked on in my entire life.
Welcome to another edition of the Columbia University Sports Podcast, the Cusp Show, where we talk about the business of sports, media, storytelling, production, gaming, all different kinds of things. We've been doing it for quite a long time. I'm Joe Favorito, along with my co-host, Tom Richardson, as we finish another semester, Tom.
Yeah, well, it's hard to believe it's over, but we're mid-May, almost mid-May. And yes, in fact, our program had its graduation this morning, mm-hmm. which I got to see a little bit of on the live stream. So congrats to all the grads on into this industry. It's always nice to see or fun to watch where they go and see how they progress in their careers. So the cycle will begin again for us, Joe, in a few months. September, I hate to say this, is not that far off. So we got to start thinking about that soon enough. Enjoy but in the meantime, the hockey yeah. and basketball fever reign in New York City.
And not just in New York, but you factor in Caitlin Clark starts the WNBA pretty soon.
Yeah, Tuesday night, right?
Tuesday night. So by the time people are listening to this, you will have seen the beginning of Caitlin Clark. An amazing thing happened, and we're going to talk a little bit about the production side and how the sausage is made and how books are made with our guests in a couple of minutes. But there was a WNBA preseason game that was not being streamed, and it was a Caitlin Clark game. And some entrepreneurial young woman sitting in the crowd turned on her phone and had 200,000 views. So guess what happened, Tom? The WNBA is now streaming every preseason game for the rest of the way. So
I love that story, Joe.
Prove the marketplace.
You know what? It was kind of refreshing in a way. Like, and this is one of the questions we'll get into with our guest about when you have great content, whether it's live or produced, what is the best way to distribute right now? Speaking of which, before we get to our guest, Joe, did you follow the story about what the National Football League may do for Christmas 2024?
Yeah, well, we're talking on Friday morning. By the time people listen to this, it may already have happened.
Be announced, yeah. I mean, so, all the insiders, John Orend and the rest of them, are predicting
this. And by the way, this is Netflix going down the street saying, we are not going to show live games. We are not going to show live games. Until we're going to show
I used some of those quotes in my class, yes.
Yeah.
But, you know, for those who may not have heard, the strong rumor in the industry is that Netflix is going to step up and buy the two exclusive games for Christmas Day 2024. And by the way, we can remind ourselves that for many years, the NFL would say, and Roger Goodell would say, we'll never do games on Tuesdays or Wednesdays. That's not the NFL. We have our thing. We have our window. But as we've learned time and time again, money talks. I can't even imagine what the fees are going to be for this doubleheader that they'll have. But we will be watching, most of America will be watching, maybe. Well, they'll definitely be watching NFL and maybe watching it on Netflix. So another milestone in the progress, I was going to say the progression or advance of TV, of the TV industry.
It's more like a millstone as we get kind of dragged down to the bottom.
Yeah, I guess so. Anyway, that's a really fascinating one. John Oren's doing a great job at Puck, by the way.
Amazing job.
A lot of good stories. Yeah.
And I'll tell you what, not just John, but now they brought in John Heilman and
I saw
the other people that they have. Every day there's something that you learn by listening to Puck. It's worth the money. There's my Earn a Bash plug for Puck.
Yeah.
But let's talk a little bit of the storytelling sausage, both from the print and the television standpoint, and a book that's been out for quite a while, but is now probably a great gift as we move, Tom, towards Father's Day. This will be after Mother's Day when people will hear this, but a longtime friend and colleague has been on the production side, making the broadcast sausage for a long, long time, numerous award winner, now an author, and came up with a great idea about the debates that we have as fans. The book is called The 20 Greatest Moments in New York Sports History. You got some help from another colleague, Gary Myers, in pulling it together. But Todd Ehrlich, welcome to the Cusp Show.
I tell you, there's no place I'd rather be, Joe. No place I'd rather be. Honored to be on the Cusp Show. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Yeah, Todd, great to have you on. I really appreciate it. And thanks for moving to New Jersey to make this happen, being in
That's right.
Joe's hometown.
Listen, I had to hunt him down. I had to find Rivervale, New Jersey, negotiate for a home during the pandemic, but it's all worth it for this moment, guys.
That's
There we go.
great. Joe, we should look at a map of the movements of our podcast guests over the last 8 years, and maybe we'll see this move towards New Jersey, this migration
Is it in
into
New
Central
Jersey or
Jersey.
Africa? As if anybody who's listened to them in a row, that's where we were last
Yeah.
week.
Let me start off with this, Todd. There's so much to talk about with your career, doing all these amazing productions, being involved in local news and local sports, producing really famous documentaries of all different stripes. A lot of them focused on sports, obviously. But when and the book was published in 2023, correct?
It just came out September 19th of last year. You're
Yeah,
100%
okay. So
correct.
2023 publication date. The concept of, to Joe's point about inciting debate for sports fans, which people love, to the 20 greatest plays, for those of us who are New Yorkers, this could take up a lot of hours of discussion with any random group of
Or
fans.
really in any city, Tom. I
In
mean,
any,
you
well,
know.
I'm saying, but for yeah, it's of course. But my question was about your decision strategically. The concept is the concept. You decided to do it as a book, which I love books. Books are one of my favorite things in all of media, but they're not exactly on fire when it comes to forms of media circa 2023, 24. A doc version of that concept maybe makes sense, at least to me. So the question is, you started with the book. Is this intended to be like a thing that will grow and kind of mirror what we're looking at in all of media right now?
So yes, I do have plans to expand upon it. I do, clearly, because it's just the way my mind works. It definitely lends itself to a TV show or series. And so all those things, yes, are indeed in my mind in the future and possible. It felt like you're beating around the bush of why I decided to write a book, and it's not because it's easy. It's the hardest project I've ever worked on in my entire life. I've launched many TV series, many TV shows, done documentaries. It was brutal. I did over 100 original interviews for the book, and I got some of the biggest names in New York sports to sit down with me, from Eli Manning to Joe Namath to Mark Messier to Bucky Dent to Bobby Nystrom. The hits just keep on coming. So it was a long process, but it was a personal process, and it was on my bucket list. My mom has written close to 20 books. My grandfather had written 15 books, and I was a charming TV producer, and I wanted to join the rest of the family. And thankfully, I had zero idea how hard it would be not only to get a publisher, but to write the book. And so I was covering Steve Serby's book with LT when that came out. It was a New York Times bestseller. And I read it, before he went out and covered it and featured it on Sports from the Roundtable. And Serby utilized a lot of interviews, and it dawned on me that I had a tremendous amount of close contacts that were writers, broadcasters, and athletes, because I not only executive produced the shows I did, but I also booked all the guests. And then I looked at Serby's book, and he had a lot of quotes in it. And I said, well, I'm good at talking to people. I don't know if I can write, but I'm good at talking to people. So then I came up with the idea. I partnered with Serby in 2003. We pitched the book around. It didn't get picked up. And so, I like to tell people I'm an overnight sensation. 2 decades later, I sold the book. It only took a couple years, 2 years to write it, nights and weekends. And here it is. The second printing's almost sold out. And I'm very proud of it, very humbled, and not joking around. It did. I spoke to Joe. I really wanted to do this. I really respect Joe. He was nice enough to write something in his newsletter, and I really wanted to come on this podcast, and it took a couple months to get a slot. So, I joke around all the time, but I am very appreciative of this opportunity.
So it's funny, what you just talked about, there's a great quote from Dorothy Parker, where she said, "I hate writing, but love having written," which I think you could probably go in your booth.
That is I've never heard that, Joe. I love that. Yeah. Boy, that captures the art and pain of writing, doesn't it?
Yeah. Todd, take us down your career path, because I think a lot of people would be interested. You mentioned your family background, which is pretty unique, the places you've worked, but just take a couple minutes before we get into the book and the story of debate and storytelling and what's in the book as to how you got here.
Okay, so it's a good question, Joe, and I've spent almost 40 years in New York sports, and again, that's really what led me to the opportunity and the idea to write this book, because of my reach and because of my relationships. I started at WPIX as a PA, then I took a job at NBA Entertainment. And if you guys remember, I produced the Fantastic Spots. I produced three films on the Celtics, Pistons, and Rockets. Then I went to Sports Channel America. I produced, Stanley Cup Finals pre-post game and between the periods. And I was a feature producer there. Then I went to WABC TV. I was a sports producer there, started my own business. And then during 9/11, Joel Goldberg, I called him up, and I had my own company, and it was certainly not a time to be doing corporate videos. So I called Joel and I said, this was Thursday. I said, "I'm sure you showed up at work Tuesday morning at 9 a.m. and you haven't been home since. If you need somebody to come in, make coffee, cut tape, log feeds, cut VOs, do features, anything you need, I want to help. I've given blood. I don't know what else to do." So he called me in. I produced The Voice of the Athlete, which was how the sports world was reacting to 9/11 there. Pitched him three TV shows. One of them became Sports from the Roundtable. So he took three treatments from NBC to WCBS. So we launched that. Then I produced that, Sports Sunday, the Sunday Blitz, a bunch of parades. When George Steinbrenner died, I produced a special on that at WCBS. Went to CBS Sports, was their coordinating producer of their Emmy division while still at WCBS and still running T-Line TV. And then most recently, I was asked to come over to WPIX. It turned out that they had a Sunday night show. And considering I was producing one at WCBS and didn't know it was even on the air, they really needed some help. They had four people, so I built the department up to 11. I brought in Moose for credibility. When Andy Adler left, I rebranded New York Sports Nation, the Sunday Night Show, renamed it, rebranded it, launched Yankee Nation, launched Big Apple Ball with Kittles and Kerry Kittles and John Wallace. I did the Blitz with Gary Myers, who helped me out with the book, Sean Lendetta and Greg Buttle the first year. Then Lendetta dropped out. I brought in David Tyree the second year. And then we created a debate format show, the first ever weekly Monday through Friday sports show on broadcast TV in New York called Nightly with Moose and Figgy, who I brought in. I spent 40 years sort of living through these moments, understanding kind of a hierarchy and sort of the history and what made the moments important. And so when I got the opportunity to write it, it was really it was the right time. And I felt equipped, and I certainly feel like spending 40 years here working in the media, that I understood the stories, the importance of the stories, and then the ability to get people to share stories that they hadn't shared before with the readers.
How did you guys actually work through the, I assume, grueling process of going through the history of New York sports for what, 63 years to get it down to 20?
So, yeah, I mean, it's an easy thing. Not a lot happens here in the Big Apple, and certainly not sports wise. So,
Well, not in the last 12 years anyway, but that's another
yeah,
story, so.
really. And so I did. So, first of all, I didn't want to write about the called shot. I don't know if it's real. I don't know if he did it or not. I don't know if he wasn't scratching and his batch is pointed. And I have no one to talk to about it. So,
Right.
I called it my generation of memories, and I started with 1960. So I would have people that I could talk to and I really knew the stories. I came up with the 20 with Serbi in 2003. And then I updated it with Gary, including I had finished writing the book when Judge went on his tear last year, hitting 62, and the book was done. I'm like, oh man. So then we had to add a chapter. And then my publisher's like, well, let's just get rid of Connors and Krickstein. I'm like, I wrote that. I did interviews. I love it. It's a bonus chapter. So I want your viewers to know that for the price of 20 moments, they get 21. That's one free chapter. I
It's the
feel like I'm
best
a
deal in
given God.
sports. Really?
It's a
Yeah.
lot of
Hey,
sports.
Todd, take us through. There's a lot in there, obviously, and it ends with, one of the greatest catches in the history of the NFL, but not to give it all away, but what were the biggest surprises that you didn't even think about when you were doing this?
Wow, great question. It's why you're good at what you do. So some of the surprises, I had no idea that Bucky Dent used his own bat to this historic home run in Fenway. Then I'm interviewing Leyritz, who was nice enough to do a book signing with me at Bookends. And he said to me when I interviewed him for the book, I have a similar story to Bucky Dent. He didn't use his own bat with his historic home run in 96, which started the dynasty, as I wrote in my book. Without his home run, they don't win 4 out of 5 because they don't win the first one. So Bucky used Mickey Rivers' bat. The King used Strawberry's bat, and there's great stories behind those. The story of what Wayne Gretzky learned from the Islanders. And I'll just tell you very quick little tidbits. So they had won 4 cups in a row, 19 straight series, and Gretzky said that they learned how to win from them. That they were little, they didn't have the nose to the grindstone mentality. And when they lost in the last cup final, when they walked by the Islanders' dressing room to a man, every Oiler talked about looking in and seeing how they were subdued and they were icing their knees, and that's what it took, that type of determination and grit to win a Stanley Cup. Okay, so I'm interviewing Trottier, and I'm like, and Jake said that the great one told him that story straight from Gretzky's mouth, right? So I'm interviewing Trotz and Nystrom, and I'm like, this is an unbelievable story, like your attitude and how you guys went about it. He goes, well, I'm going to tell you something nobody knows, which was my favorite thing to get from athletes. And I ended every interview with that. I said, tell me something. A story that you guys tell when you get together, but other people don't know. So he said, here's the deal. We had a stick boy, we sent him outside of the locker room. And as soon as he saw somebody coming, we toned it down. As soon as they passed by, we went nuts again. And he said it was like a roller coaster of toning things down and going nuts. But still, that left an impression. It left an impression on me. The fact that Steve DiBiase and Zach DiBiase are the only father and son with the Giants to win a Super Bowl. And Steve DiBiase filmed the wide right kick in the locker room. I had no idea he filmed it personally, what that meant to him and what it meant to him to share it. And then he was a Patriots broadcaster when he snuck down to the sidelines. And Zach watches the helmet catch, and all of a sudden behind him, he hears, psst, Zach, psst. He turns around, right? And he's like, Dad, what are you doing here? And he obviously used his media credentials to sneak down there. And he's like, I think you're gonna win. And Zach goes, shut up, Dad, you're gonna jinx us, which I can hear my 6-year-old saying to me, shut up, Dad, you're gonna jinx us. It was just classic. And then with Steve talking about how he was the only person in the building to know the emotions that Zach was going through and what that meant to him. I mean, listen, I could do, I don't know if we have 45 minutes, I could do 45 minutes on stories that I learned, and I'd be happy. I don't want to sort of commandeer a talk until you guys say goodbye, but I have stories of Haas missing the bus after the NFC championship game. OJ Anderson predicting he'd be the MVP in the Super Bowl if he started as the feature back when he was at the U. I mean, I have so many stories that me, as somebody that covered all these events and covered sports in New York since 84, didn't know. The fact to be able to write a book and share them, I'm just proud that I had the reach, the respect from the people of the industry, the trust of these athletes and broadcasters. And I'll tell you something that's interesting. I got a lot of dirt that people shared with me, and I wouldn't put it in the book. And let me tell you, it would have made the book sell a lot better because it's all anybody would have written about. But for me, this book is for generations to share with other generations, parents to share with their children. And I wanted positive stories, and I wanted to pass down these stories, and I wasn't looking for dirt. I think the world is in a spot where it's a little bit tough, right? If you read the news, you guys are at Columbia. There might have been some news surrounding your campus recently. I don't know if you heard about it, but it might have gotten to you. And so the world is in a little bit of a tough spot. And I didn't want to dish dirt. So I wanted the book to be positive. And I think it's page after page of smile after smile, whether you remember it or you're learning it and sharing it with the next generation.
Hey, Todd, how many sports were represented out of the 20?
So that's a great question. Six on the Yankees, three on the Mets, that's one sport. One on the Jets, three on the Giants, that's two. There was obviously the Messier guarantee in the Islanders dynasty, that's three. Ash and Connors is four. Willis Reed is five. Tiger Woods is six. Secretariat is seven. Ali is eight.
Wow. Okay. Interesting. Are there any, with all the different experiences you've had covering different sports?
Sure.
Are there ones that are better at producing great stories?
Good question.
Based on kind of the vibe of the sport? Like, for example, in the world of hockey, they're notoriously very kind of stoic athletes. They're not typically not flamboyant. They're usually quieter, let's say, compared to some other sports. You know what I mean? So is that something you consider when you're looking at how to produce stories?
Sure. You have to consider it. Yeah. And I agree with your assessment. Hockey players tend to be more humble, more homespun. However, I look at it differently. Hockey players are the most approachable from top to bottom of the roster. And if you're a good interviewer, which I humbly believe I am, it's subjective, but whatever, I think I'm a good interviewer. If they're approachable, then you now have the opportunity to get better stories out of them. Football players are approachable. Basketball players are less approachable. And also some teams make you go to the podium where you're not going to get anything. You need to establish relationships, and baseball players are the worst of all of them. But what I have found is you have to have go-to guys in locker rooms. You have to have people, and you also have to earn their trust by, especially in New York, you can ask tough questions and you have to ask tough questions, but they have to be fair. They can never be, in my opinion, everyone's different, but they shouldn't be gotcha questions. They should be fair questions. And what are you? You're a conduit to the fans, right? So what are the questions they're looking for? What are the answers they're looking for? You're somebody that, if you have the privilege of having a credential and the ability to interview these guys, that you feel like you know the sports, you know the storylines, you have the ability to ask the questions. You need to learn, you need to earn the respect. So, and that goes not only with the questions you ask, but how you treat these guys. I'll give you an example. WCBS TV, I went up to cover opening day. It was, I don't know, 5, 6 years ago. Do you remember when it snowed for 2 days in a row on opening day for the Yankees? Okay, so I go up the first day. I go do the interviews. I, you know, send everything back. Second day, I come up. And I go into the clubhouse, and it's a ghost town. There's more people in my office now than were in that clubhouse that morning when the media was allowed in. All of a sudden, Aaron Judge comes walking through. I'm like, Aaron, I need you. Can I get two questions? He says to me, look, give me 35 minutes. Noon, we'll knock it out. And I said, Aaron, I can't. At noon, Skip is talking. We're feeding it back live, and we're only on from 12 to 12:30. Is there any way you could just do it now? He goes, all right. He goes back into the clubhouse. He comes back. He says, I told my trainer, give me 15 minutes. So you can't interview him in the clubhouse either because it's the Yankees rule. I don't know, man. So I take him out into the hallway. So it's a pretty big ask, right? He's changing his schedule. He goes all the way into the hallway. Like vultures, the entire media descends on me and Aaron because nobody got anyone else to come out. So I asked my two questions, and he's standing there staring at me like, you are Tom, with a smile on his face. And he's like, Todd, anything else? And I said, no, I promised you two questions. That's it. He says, all right. So I walk back into the clubhouse with him. He's like, Todd, you had me. I would have answered anything you wanted. I said, Aaron, I'm a man of my word. When I say two questions, it's two questions. I said, let me ask you a question. Who helped you? Did you help me or did I help you? He goes, well, I rearranged stuff. I said, yes, you helped me. So I'm going to honor my word. So because of that, when he hit his 62, I was covering the last playoff game, which they lost. They were swept by Houston. Afterwards, everybody was thanking him. And there was a rumor, obviously, that he could leave. So this is my last chance to talk to him, but it didn't feel like the right place to ask him about his record when they had just lost. So everyone's lining up, thanking him because he treated everybody fairly. So I said to him, I waited to be last. And I said, Aaron, you know, congratulations. I really want to thank you. Every time we were in a scrum, he would call on me. Do you know what I mean? Like, he just treated me great. So I said, really? I said, I just want you to know that I appreciate that from a media member. It was a pleasure to cover you. And I said, but you sort of added some work to my plate. He goes, what do you mean? That's why this book written, my publisher demanded that I do a chapter on you because it's 62 home runs. So he was laughing. He thought it was hysterical. I said, can I ask you one question for the book? And I said, if this is the wrong time, let's not do it. Like, I get it, you know? He goes, no, go ahead. So I said to him, I said, I was here a tremendous amount this summer, and I've been covering guys in clubhouses for 40 years. The poise that you handled, the pressure, the fact that you answered every question to the media, the fact that you were available pregame and postgame, and you were open and honest. And the thing I like best about you, Aaron, is when somebody asks you a difficult question, you take a beat. Like, you don't feel rushed to answer. I've never seen anyone else do that. To answer it, how did you find it within yourself under all this pressure to show this much class? And he said, well, first of all, thank you. It's very nice. He said, but when I was a kid and I got autographs from players, it resonated with me. That 10 seconds of time that I can give somebody talking to you is talking to the fans. You guys are a conduit. Can resonate with a child someplace. So I take that very seriously, no matter what's going on in my life outside and outside pressures. I took that very seriously. And so I felt I had one question, and I wanted to ask a question that wasn't asked 10,000 times. What did it feel at the 62nd home run? He was elated. What are you talking about? You know? So I felt very good about that. And I felt very good that I had the relationship with him, that he was willing to answer that. I felt like I had a good question. I felt like, you know, I shared something with the readers that they're not going to find anyplace else.
Great. Aaron Judge, I would hate to say, but probably true, the exception, not the rule to athlete media relationships these days. Todd, how has it changed just in the last few years since the pandemic? I mean, we're talking on a Zoom call, which people wouldn't have thought of, but from a broadcast perspective, is the access good, better, the same, different over the last 3 or 4 years?
Well, it's completely different. And, You know, when you asked me to come on the podcast, I thought I was coming over to the Favoritos for lunch first. So you had the opportunity to go Zoom. So I lost out on a lunch, which I'm not happy about, but I'm going to hold you to, whether it's in town or at your house.
The Vail Cafe coffee at 3:30 today. I'll be
there. You go. I'm in. Sign me up. But to answer your question, it is completely and wholly different. And it is not better. The athletes used to, if they wanted to get a message out, they had the ability to do that through us. And as I talked a little bit earlier, I always had relationships within locker rooms with guys that could pull me over, button on me and say, you know, here's what's going on. For example, Tim Carter pulled me over after Strahan's first year with Coughlin. They were 0-2. They finally got the win at Giant Stadium, and Stray gave Coughlin the game ball. Well, Carter told me that. Nobody in the media knew that. Strahan's press conference was done. Coughlin's press conference was done. And at that point, I had a choice. Do I go ask Strahan about it? Everyone has the story. Or do I keep it to myself? So I went and asked Stray, and I just felt journalistically that was the right thing to do to get his take on why he did it. But the point is, I would never have a chance today to have that exclusive or to get background from somebody, because the players would put it out on their own social media. If they want something out, they don't need me. They don't need me at WPIX, WCBS, WABC, WNBC, wherever else I've worked. They can put it out themselves. So they control their own message. That is the biggest difference. So getting exclusive stories is almost impossible because they want to control it. They're not as open and honest in locker rooms because they don't have to be. They can get out their own stories. And I don't, as a member of the media, I don't think that it's better, because I also feel like as a journalist, it's just as I spoke to Carter, then I went to Strahan, right? I feel as a journalist, to have all the sides tells a better story than if Stray just shared it himself or Carter just shared it himself. So I think it's worse.
Todd, it's a really interesting point. That relates to one of the questions I had for you about your thoughts on the growth of athletes essentially making themselves, building their own media businesses around their brands. This ranges from LeBron James to Kevin Durant, J.J. Redick with podcasts, and there's a zillion examples, Draymond Green, the Kelce brothers, et cetera. Does there need to be some level of objectivity to get the best result? So let me just extend the question. You also know a major trend has been the success of major sports documentaries in the streaming world, Drive to Survive, et cetera. One of the biggest ones early pandemic was The Last Dance. And it is my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, you guys, that Michael Jordan had approval rights on everything in that documentary.
Yep.
That obviously has to then present and tell a different story than if it's 100% objective through a third party. So can you talk about that? Because when I watch docs now, I wonder what's really going on here vis-a-vis objectivity. I'm a little bit suspicious sometimes. And I know that the Netflix did not renew, for example, tennis, because apparently they didn't get enough cooperation from the WTA and the two associations. Anyway, it's an interesting topic right now, because I think a lot of us, or a lot of people, watch documentaries and they're not necessarily thinking about what's going on behind the scenes with the editorial considerations.
So you're right. Jordan did have the right of first refusal. That's why it took so long to come out. Because he had to approve it being made. I was at NBA Entertainment, and Andrew Thompson really shot a lot of that doc, and he's an old buddy of mine. And if you'll recall, Pippen came out and complained a lot because he felt that it was really slanted towards his airness, if you will. Mm-hmm. And as entertaining as it was, and as well produced as it was, you do have to now watch it through the filter of there's stuff in it that Michael Jordan didn't want you to see. So it's not 100% objective. When I was at NBA Entertainment working on the Bad Boys film or Celtic Pride or Hanging Tough on the Rockets, Yes, we worked for the league. So, yes, there was a level of control or filter on it, but still it was objectively produced and created retrospect of their seasons. And now when people have a chance to put their thumbprint on it, it's not as objective. And I feel like it hurts the documentaries because if you're giving your time, you want to come away with that's exactly what happened. Well, now you've got to do a little research about what you're watching because you need to know who was the P on it, who had editorial control.
Do you think this is happening with all these docs? So, for example, I'm an F1 fan and I've been into Drive to Survive. And sometimes I'm watching Drive to Survive and I'm wondering how far are they going in terms of controlling what ultimately gets seen by the viewers? Because we know we've all worked in the business. I worked in two leagues and was involved in the media side with the NFL and NHL. So, for example, at the NFL with NFL Films, they would do amazing work. But a lot of it wasn't objective per se when it came to the more controversial issues. They didn't do videos called the 20 greatest concussions in NFL history or
Right.
something like that.
Right.
So it's an interesting question when you have these different parts of the business, the leagues, the rights holders themselves doing media, the athletes themselves doing media, the professional producers such as yourself doing media, and it's not all equal. Necessarily. I don't mean to belabor this point. It's an interesting question for where we are right now.
So the due diligence and the onus is on you as the viewer to do a little research
Right.
ahead of time.
Great
Who's the
point.
executive producer? Who's putting this out? And then you'll get an idea of perspective. Now, this doesn't mean you shouldn't watch it, doesn't mean it's not interesting, but
Right.
it does mean when you're having an argument about the 20 greatest moments in New York sports history or any other sports topic, and you're looking to quote a you're looking to go ahead and quote a documentary or something you saw, you need to say, well, this was produced through the filter of Michael Jordan, you know? So if Pippen's coming out and saying something, you need to take that into consideration.
Yeah, and that applies to news circa 2024 as much as perhaps even more, I
Well,
would add.
I mean, I'm a sports producer. You know, I have spent some time in the news. I've produced the morning news at WCBS and some suite specials and some news specials and Tunnel to Tower and Coleman Race for the Cure. But I will say that it's the exact same thing I told you about watching a doc, right? If you are watching news on a certain station, you need to say, okay, is this a national network? So is it fair and balanced and down the middle? Or is it a network that says they're fair and balanced and maybe to the right, and you need to just watch it through that filter. And you also need to watch what is presented as journalism and what is presented as commentary. And when I started at WPIX, my news director said to me, you have 3 weeks to create an NFL show. Why don't you just have Andy Adler interview Joe Mosseri and Justin Walters? And I said, well, Joe and Justin are journalists. They're not experts in the field. They're not analysts. They are journalists, and we need them to present the news, and we don't need to hear their NFL opinions on the NFL pregame show. They will lose their credibility if they talk about how awful the Jets are, then Jet fans are going to watch the sports report and they're going to be listening through that filter of he doesn't like the Jets. So there's a delineation between journalism and then folks that are opinion makers like Stephen A. Smith, for example. And he doesn't say he's a journalist. He was at the Philadelphia Inquirer, but he's an opinion maker. That's
Right.
what he's paid slightly more than I was paid to do because he's also good at it. But
Yeah.
they're his opinions. So you need to know where you're watching something, who is the executive producer, and what the format of the show is. So all these things, there's a huge onus on the viewer now It's not Walter Cronkite anymore taking off his glasses, telling you that we just lost JFK. You know, the most trusted man in America is no longer the news broadcaster. And it's sad and it's upsetting, but it is true. And we all have to put on our big boy pants and deal with that and understand it. And I think that your questions, Tom, are exceedingly important, and exceedingly relevant and exceedingly timely.
Before we get to a little bit of the nitty-gritty of the book, which I know Tom wants to touch on some of the debates.
The book.
Leading to the book, on the editorial side, was there a debate as to, did an editor come to you and say, you can't put this in, you got to move this to three, or were you guys kind of had the ability to do it on your own?
So it's a phenomenal question. It's an interesting question. The way it came about, like I said, I came up with the 21st survey. The way, and you talked a little bit in your email about wanting to know about publishing and how it works. I had to write it was probably a 40-page proposal. Who am I? Why am I qualified to write the book? What contacts do I have that I can add to the book? What are the chapters in the book? And then write a sample chapter. So I had that document. Now it changed a little bit from 03 until I guess it was 19 when I got the book deal. 19 or 20 when I got the book deal. But I used that to write the chapters. Then Gary and I went through and he obviously looked at all the chapters. There was nothing in there that he wanted to take out and nothing that he wanted to add. And you know Gary exceedingly well, Joe. He has opinions on everything, including that lamp and the placement of it in your office. So I felt good that somebody that is as respected as Gary, a Hall of Fame voter, and will hopefully soon get into the NFL Hall of Fame as a writer, agreed with the 20. But then once we wrote all the chapters, we did sit down and we played the shell game of moving it around. But that, to answer your question now directly, the publisher had already bought the book with the chapters as is. I went to him and said, I really think we should add Aaron Judge. I do not want to write another chapter, but I think it'd be a miss if we didn't have it in. And he wholeheartedly agreed with that. But then he wanted me to take out Connors and Crickstein, so I fought to keep it in. And then the way the process goes is I wrote it. Then I had friends in the business fact check it. Ken Davidoff, Steve Serby. So Serby did the NFL. Davidoff did baseball. Tim Rapley did hockey. Gary did all the NFL. And then they had two editors for me at Skyhorse Publishing. One edited sort of the grammar and spelling and that kind of stuff, and the other fact checked the book. So that was the process. And then there was things like the cover of the book where I thought it was important to put on that I did over 100 interviews. Like, I think that's what makes the book special. And there was some resistance, and I'm like, I really sort of demand that because I think it's going to sell the book. I think it goes to the credibility of the book. Why are they going to buy the book? And then things like the pictures on the cover, I didn't want two black and white pictures. He said to me, don't fight this one. You'll have plenty of things you're going to want to fight. Don't use your bullets on this. So, you know, they had a lot to do with the book, but they didn't change any of the moments at all.
All right, Joe, before we go to the final question, group of questions, just a couple of quick hits. Based on your experience doing the book and the many, many, many interviews you've done over the course of your long career, you can only answer with one name. Most colorful athlete you've ever met. Unique, interesting, outrageous, just colorful.
Well, first of all, his name is three names. Am I allowed to do that?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. So, I would say Hector Macho Camacho. You would ask him a question. He would go on for 20 minutes. You'd forget what you asked him. Then you'd ask him another one. He was super colorful. The only time, and I mean, I've interviewed, people that have been president and senators and Super Bowl champions, World Series champions, Stanley Cup champions. The only time I ever was in awe is maybe too strong, but moved was I got to spend the afternoon with Muhammad Ali
Knew that would
at
be it.
a book signing. And at the end of it, I said to him, I said, I've never done this before and I will never do it again because it's against the rules of journalism. But you are the most famous man on the planet. You have been exceedingly gracious. I mean, we hung out for like 3 hours talking about everything on the planet Earth. Is there any way I could get you to sign the book? And he's like, what do you mean? Of course. We just spent 3 hours together. But it's like, Joe, you don't do that. We are, it says on the back of our press credentials, but it was Ali. Like, I mean, I had just been with, it was Ali. So I'm a little ashamed that I did it, but I just couldn't not.
I think it was justified. All right, two more quick ones.
Yeah.
Most likable and most unlikable.
Can be the same person too, whether.
Okay.
Right, depending on when you interviewed them.
Well, so most likable and most unlikable. Most likable is David Tyree. He did my Blitz show, and one of the most professional people I ever dealt with. He came in prepared, he came in early, and he would sit on my couch in my office at Channel 11. And we would talk about business philosophy. We would talk about family. We would talk about just how to treat people. And, he said to me, he said, because we didn't really pay him anywhere. I don't even want to get into it. But, and he said, you know what, Todd? He goes, I do this for a couple reasons. One, I want a career in TV. I'm interested. This is something I'm interested in. You're always prepared. You always make me look good. I always look good on your shows. You always tell me ahead of time what we're going to talk about. You tell me the B-roll we're going to use. We talk everything through. And he said, also, you just treat people well. Like you just treat everybody well, from the people that work for you to the people that are on your shows. And so you're the type of guy that people go out of their way for, and that's how I got 100 interviews, obviously. Marv Albert did an interview with me for probably 45 minutes, called me the next day and said, I thought of three more things and talked to me for another half hour. Like, I mean, come on, pinch me, the most unlikable athlete. I'm the type guy that I find something good in everybody and
Good answer.
something to like about in everybody.
All right. How about a variation on that? Since I can understand that response. The most difficult to deal with.
Was difficult to deal with. Can I go into my corporate world for that?
Yeah, for
Is
sure.
that okay?
Well, and
Okay.
that might even be better for me and Joe.
Okay. So I mean, it's related to sports. I don't want you guys to think that I'm ignoring our topic at hand. So the Citizenship Through Sports Alliance was a collaboration of the NFL, Major League Baseball, NBA, all the pro leagues, the USOC, the NCAA, down to the National High School Federation. And it was about citizenship and what kids can learn through sports. Okay. So focus on respect was the tagline. So they hired my company, T-Line TV, to do all the corporate videos and all the national PSAs. And we had, I don't know, Sammy Sosa and a million other guys. Well, we wanted General Powell. At the time, he was Secretary of State and one of the most respected, he was a leader. He was one of the most respected guys on the planet Earth. Okay. So, and he had a foundation for kids. So it took a year dealing with his people to get him. A year, Joe. a year of my life to get him to do a 30-second PSA. So we go down to Virginia. I set up the tracks for the camera, so we have a nice dolly. I got the teleprompter. I'm there 4 hours early. We have everything set up. General Powell comes up. We shake hands. I say, right over here, we're all set up for you. Really appreciate you doing this. We knock out the lines, right, in like 5 minutes. I was told I had 15 minutes with him. So he goes, you know, he goes, what else do you want me to do? I said, could you do a couple of the taglines so I can then use him on the end of other spots, right? Because I had a bunch of different spots, like the fantastic spots at the NBA, which I produced. So he knocked those out, and we're at 14 minutes. He goes, what else do you need, Todd? I go, I have like 1 minute, 59 seconds left with you. He goes, what? What are you talking about? I said, I have 15 minutes from you leaving the car to that car door slamming. Like, that's what we had to negotiate. That was it. And we got to go because it's about 40-second walk to your car. He goes, are you out of your mind? He goes, I'm here as long as you need me. I said, that wasn't the deal I made. And I always keep my deal. He goes, this is important. So I go, could you play basketball with the kids? So some kid comes up to him, no look magic pass to another kid, goes up for a layup. Colonel Powell tries to block it, doesn't get it. It goes in the basket, and he's like, teamwork, that's teamwork. Well, I had a lob on him. That was the best part of the whole PSA, that Nat pop. So what I learned, and it happened with a million other people, is the athletes or the dignitaries are not usually the bad people. It's the PR folks, yeah. No offense, Joe.
Yeah, okay.
But it's right. The PR yeah. folks that block everything.
He's so right.
Right.
It comes down to building, you know, one of the things I put updated in the book is we have to build bridges, not walls. And unfortunately, most people on the communication side of the business with high level people are building walls, not bridges.
It's Joe, awesome. You know that we always shudder when we ask someone to be on the pod and they say, I'd love to be on the pod, but I need to get corp comms involved.
Yeah. For what? Yeah. For all
never
the guy.
Good. Never good. And most of the time, those people don't make it, make it to the end.
Yeah. So Todd, you've been around both on the broadcast side and your own personal business. What advice do you give to people either looking to change careers or get involved in starting up a career? And then you have to keep your hands in so many different things. How do you stay up to date with everything that you need to stay smart?
Okay. So the two questions are, so it's not for a young guy. It's for somebody looking to change careers. Yeah.
Just in general.
Okay, so in general, for a young person, when I was in college, I worked at I worked at WJZ, I worked at the Fox affiliate in DC, I worked at the Sports Machine, then I ran out of stations in the nation's capital. I went up to WJZ in Baltimore and worked there. I worked at WABC during the summers in WMUC, and then also WFDU. I didn't get paid a penny for any of them. And without those contacts, I never would have had the career I had. I think working for free is fine if it's something that you love and want to do. For somebody that's in the business or somebody that's looking to break into the business, every job is an opportunity. So like if you go to tlinetv.com, right, and you hit play on any of the videos, there's no price tag. There's no budget. You don't know whether I got six figures from Tom's old NFL or I got $5,000 from a company. It is your work. So do the very best you can because your name is on everything you do. And the last thing is take every job you can. Even if you're losing a little bit of money on it because you don't know who you're going to meet and you don't know where they're going next and you impress them, how do you know that they don't have a huge job with the NFL and all of a sudden you're working for the Shield next?
Mm-hmm. And then how do you stay up to date with everything that you need to do? Where do you go for your news?
So, you know, I read the Washington Post for news. I read the New York Post for sports news. There's this little thing that used to be called Twitter, that they now just called X, that a lot of people share news on. For sports, I like The Athletic. There's a lot of different journalists that I grew up reading. I mean, they've done a really nice job of giving people a second career. I watch ESPN, and then in New York, local news is quote unquote dying, but you want 4 minutes on what's the most important stuff that happened in New York that day. Look at the local news that night. You've got really smart producers putting it together. You've got very smart broadcasters delivering it. And you will know in 4 minutes the most important stories that happened that day.
And the book. Let's give it one more shot for the book. Tell
One
us,
more.
so tell us a little bit about in a real quick synopsis, like the things that you want people to walk away from, whether they are big sports fans, New York sports fans, or casual fans, what are the three or four things that they should know or that they should be looking forward to for when they buy the book?
Specific stories or just what I want them to get from the book, because it's two different answers.
What you'd like them to walk away from the book?
Okay, so I mean, to be fair, I did share, I touch on a lot of the stories that were in the book. The most important thing that I want is I want people to smile when they read the book. That's first of all. I want them to be able to escape into this and smile and bring back amazing memories. I was with my father at that game. I watched that with my best friend. I was at that game. So I want to bring back memories. And I did something called the time capsule. So who won the Oscar? Who won the Grammy? Who was mayor of New York? Who was president? Who won the Heisman? So I take people back. Oh, I remember that song. I remember that movie. You know, I was in high school at that time, and then I do a pregame, which builds up to the moment. What were the big trades? What were the big coaching moves? What were the big games? And then we have an article by Peter Boddy on the moment, then the postgame. So I really want people to also be able to share from generation to generation. I have a 6-year-old, so I want him to be able to read a chapter. I'll read the same chapter. Then at dinner, we talk about it and the meaning of it. And now as he goes through his life, he has a basis for, you know, when Brunson gets hurt, oh my God, Daddy, that's like Willis Reed. And you talked about him. And I think it'll make them smarter and also makes sports is built on history. So to know the history really makes you a smarter sports fan and appreciate it more.
Cool. Tom, wrap us up.
Yeah, Todd, that was great. Thank you so much. And congratulations on publishing the book and on its second printing. We know in the book world, a second printing means you've hit a good mark, and it's a good sign that the audience is responding. But I actually, as you were talking and thinking about people I'd like to buy the book for, some of my New York sports friends, because I think especially with people of a certain age, and I'm guessing based on this history, maybe 50 plus, it's not to say it's not for younger people, but I think a lot of New York sports fans, 50 plus, will definitely want this. So well done. I'm interested to see where it can go. We don't get into it now, but I'm kind of curious if you kind of keep this alive somehow through additional iterations of it in video or gaming or whatever trivia. So thank you on behalf of the program and of Joe. Todd Ehrlich, one of the legendary producers in the business, especially in New York. What an amazing career, what an amazing set of accomplishments, and what an amazing kind of current act you've got going right now in one of the hottest parts of the business, which is figuring out the way in a very disrupted media world to tell stories and still do it effectively. And the fact that you've been able to roll through, as we like to say in my digital media class, Web 1 disruption, Web 2 disruption, now the beginning of Web 3, you've obviously found the answer as to how to evolve when you're in the business you're in. So congratulations on all that. Thank you again, and appreciate everybody listening. Thanks for Mike Schroeder behind the scenes producing. If anybody's got any thoughts on topics or guests we ought to consider, please reach out to me or Joe. We wish you all well, and we'll see you on the next episode.
And one quick thing, Tom?
Sure.
Okay. If folks with Father's Day coming up, if they want to buy a book and have it personally dedicated, which I've done a lot of that around the Christmas holidays, I'll write it to the dad in your life, whether it's your dad or if a wife is buying it for their husband, you know, for their children for Father's Day, June 15th at the brand new Barnes & Noble on Route 17. I'm giving a 45-minute talk, and I'm signing and dedicating books. June 2nd at the Franklin Lakes Library, I'm doing the same thing. And then at the University Club, if you happen to be watching and you're a member, May 29th, I'm giving a talk and a book signing. And this book makes a great gift, like you said, for Father's Day. And if you can get it personally dedicated to the biggest Yankee fan of all time, and then I'll sign it and date it, it makes it a special gift as well.
That's a nice offer. I'm glad you brought up the appearance dates because I know how important they are in promoting books. So, and I'm sorry we forgot to do that. All right. Well, thanks again, Todd. Have a nice summer, and good luck selling, promoting the book over the next few months.
Thank you. And thank you for the opportunity, Joe, and a pleasure to meet you, Tom. Thank you.
Thank you all again.